Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, we're coming a couple days late than our normal release schedule, I guess.
Yeah, between the boat trip making me a little late and you getting sick, it kind of combined to put us way behind.
It's like that Jimmy Buffett album, Boats, Beaches, and Bronchitis.
That's right. Not the kind you want to get. I'll take the first two. You can have the third, which you do.
Well, I don't know that I have bronchitis, but I had a chest cold that turned into an ear infection that just wouldn't go away until I saw the doctor.
Yeah.
So they gave me steroids, antibiotics, a nasal spray, an inhaler, and a cough suppressant.
And it made it so you were able to get up out of bed 24 hours later, huh?
That's right, yeah.
But, well, we're glad to have you with us there, Mike. Thought we were going to lose you for a while.
It was touch and go there for a little bit.
I know. I was interviewing lawyers to replace you as you were laying in bed. So just in case, I had to have a contingency plan. The other one that was suggested is I have Charlie come up and fill in for you because she did such a good job on still buffering.
There you go. Yeah, maybe Charlie could do it.
Yeah, she'll talk about anything. She's got opinions. Hey, one thing I wanted to bring up, you know, we always have people post on our site, on our Facebook page, the things, the exploits of the Florida man.
Oh, yeah, Florida man. That's almost become like a meme.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many things. It's like, where is he from? Just guess.
Own Reddit subpage, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable. Florida man. And it's well-deserved that he has that reputation, so the dumb stuff that he does.
Yeah.
But we had our own Florida man. We had a West Virginia man here.
West Virginia man?
Yeah, a small city just outside of Huntington. They had the guy that said that I'm not going to name him, but said the police officers came upon him and they arrested him for DUI, driving with a revoked license, and it was his second misdemeanor, and DUI with a minor misdemeanor. So in other words, this guy's driving and he's got a kid in the car too. He doesn't have a driver's license. And it said that police located a half-empty bottle of bootlegger liquor, an empty can of Grape 4 Loco, and a half-empty can of Steel Reserve in the vehicle. So the guy can't decide what he wants to drink, and all those are bad choices. The only one he finished was the 4 Loco, a Grape 4 Loco.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he doesn't have very good taste.
He was all jacked up on 4 Loco.
Yeah, and then on top of that, he had two previous convictions in West Virginia for DUI from 2009 and 2016 and has three previous convictions for driving on a revoked license for DUI from 2014, 15, and 16, and his blood alcohol level registered at 0.117, which 0.08 is the legal limit. So he was well over the limit with his kid in the car.
0.117 is pretty high, but I've seen higher.
But here's the thing that really got me. They got a picture of him in the paper. And you look at this picture, and he's standing there in his gym shorts and his backwards ball cap and his shirt that reads, Dad, the man, the myth, the legend. So this guy is representing all dads everywhere. He's the man, the myth, and the legend, the dad. With all these DUIs, driving revoked, his minor child in the car with him. And he's the preeminent dad. Do us a favor. Men have a bad enough reputation. Don't let a guy like that have that T-shirt. He should have beer shirts or something. Or he should have, you know, those T-shirts that look like a girl's body with a bikini on or something like that. Something like that. But a dad T-shirt he should not have. They should not be able to sell them to people like that.
You know what I'd call that guy if he came in my office?
What?
A possible client.
A possible client? He is a client.
No,
he
he'd have
somebody.
He'd have to come proper, as they say, with some payment to retain my services.
Oh, my God. I couldn't believe that when they showed the picture. I mean, it was bad enough, all the charges. But when I saw the picture and he's wearing that shirt, just give dads everywhere a bad reputation.
Well, I'll tell you what. He's presumed innocent. You hear that, West Virginia man? I'll represent you if you come to my office.
He's not presumed innocent. Look at that record. He's been doing this for a long time, and nothing's going to change it. Put him in jail and don't let him out.
But that all that doesn't prove that he was guilty this time.
He was. He was.
Well, now, you and I both probably know that, but...
If it walks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck. And that That's guy's true. A duck.
But if it walked like a duck in the past... Does that necessarily mean it's walking like a duck now?
That's a staggering duck at 0.117. Good luck with that duck.
I read an article. This is before you went on your boat trip.
And, with my boat drinks.
That's right. And it was in the New York Times. And so this was like a couple weeks ago. And the article was called Judges Plead Guilty to a Scheme in Jails for Youth Profit. And I thought it was a fairly current article. Because I saw what I thought was February 2019. But when I started looking at it again, it was February 2009. So it's not quite too recent. But it was such an interesting story that I thought we should probably talk about it.
Well, all right then. Let's do. Because it's not like it doesn't still exist.
That's true. And actually...
Maybe this particular crime isn't still happening, but it the same situation that set it up is.
With the appeals process, it may still be going on, actually.
Well, that's true.
This is actually a... featured in a Michael Moore documentary called Capitalism, a Love Story. That was the name of it. And it was called Kids for Profit, I think it was, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so it kind of deals with the bigger issue we're going to talk about as well, private prisons or prisons for profit. It's a place where people are sentenced to, and it's actually run by a third party that's contracted by a government agency. So that's the kind of situation we're looking at. Now, the private prison... they enter some sort of contract with governments that commit prisoners to them, and they pay them either per day or a monthly rate for each prisoner in the facility. And basically, you can kind of see where that's going to set up a little bit of a conflict of interest right off the bat in my mind.
Right.
I mean, so without further ado, let's get more into this story. Then we'll talk a lot about conflicts of interest.
Yeah, because they have the private juvenile facilities and private prisons for adults.
That's true. Yeah, I was talking about just in the general idea of a private prison. It's kind of the same thing, but there's some for juveniles and there's some for adults.
And that's I won't say a recent thing, but I mean in the history of man, all prisons were run by the government for a long time. And then just in the last, 30 years maybe, they've developed private prisons where... somebody said, hey, we could make a buck doing this. The governments got tired of building prisons and also staffing them because then they're government employees, and government employees, you get all the benefits that go along with that. So it's very expensive to run prisons.
Yeah, you think, well, it's kind of a trend there for a while to privatize everything.
And then the other thing that changed was the way they started the war on drugs.
Yeah.
And they started criminalized marijuana and all that. And so then you got the big influx into the prisons and the juvenile system because of that. And so the prisons that supposedly were supposed to hold everything couldn't. So that's when we turned to the privateers.
And then the privateers start lobbying more and say, hey, this is good stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's some money to be made. They wouldn't be doing it if there wasn't money to be made.
So this story that from 2009 started out with about a woman named Hillary Transu. I say woman, she was actually a child at that point. She bullied...
She grew into a woman.
I assume so now. I don't know. It's 10 years old.
But she was a woman.
She had bullied the assistant principal on MySpace.
Oh my gosh, that's how old this was.
Yeah, that's probably been my first indicator. I may have been sick back then when I first looked at this and didn't realize that. Talking about MySpace, like, what? Who uses MySpace? And she was sentenced in 2007. So, and basically,
she bullied the principal, say you fell off your dinosaur or something?
Well, she said at the bottom of the page it was a joke, but basically, she'd never really been in trouble before, and she thought she was just kind of making a joke. She, like I said, she put that at the bottom of the MySpace page, and she figured when she went in front of this judge that she would maybe get a stern lecture, some community service, or something like that, but instead, the judge locked her up for 3 months at a juvenile detention center. She was handcuffed and taken away as her parents stood there in shock.
Well, I would be too.
So...
and this was like, I don't know if she was an honor roll student, but she made good grades, wasn't a troublemaker, and head of a bunch of clubs and stuff like that.
Yeah, but evidently, like, this was not kind of a strange thing that happened in front of this judge. This judge, Mark Ciavarelli, and another judge was Michael Conahan. They appeared in federal court and pled guilty to wire fraud and income tax fraud for taking more than $2.6 million in kickbacks in a scam to send teenagers to two privately run youth detention centers run by PA Child Care and its sister company, Western PA Care. So basically, these two judges handed down different sentences to make sure these private juvenile facilities were kept full of juveniles.
And they got kickbacks based on how full they kept them, huh?
They were. And as of when this was discovered, it seemed that about 5,000 juveniles had been sentenced since it started in 2003. And most of the kids were first-time offenders, and some of them were actually still in detention when this all came out in about 2008. So what happened was the judge secured contracts with the facilities and saw that basically the centers were filled, and then he got the kickbacks for it. And oddly enough, we're talking about Florida earlier, they ran it through their Florida company.
Wow.
So all this stuff always goes through Florida, one way or another. So if you think about it, the way this was set up, it was actually kind of a perfect scheme. Juvenile proceedings are confidential, so no one else really can be in there, the public or the news or things like that. And basically, children are not required to have child advocates or attorneys there in Pennsylvania.
Now, so most of them don't because they don't know what they're getting in for.
Exactly. Now, I will say that is different than here in West Virginia. Although West Virginia does not look like it's one of the mandatory places that juveniles have attorneys, I've never seen a juvenile hearing where there wasn't an attorney there. But then again, maybe it's because I don't get to go to the ones where they don't get an attorney. But
they get a court-appointed one, if nothing else, huh?
They do, or a public defender. Mm-hmm. But all juveniles have attorneys. So these two judges, who I pretty much think are basically the scum of the earth, and I've come out before saying I'm not in favor of the death penalty. I'm probably more in favor of the death penalty for these two schmucks than I am from somebody that killed somebody.
They made their money off of children's suffering and tears.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me sick to my stomach that these guys...
They threw away people's lives and didn't care as long as they were getting the bucks.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's horrible.
It's just, I mean, because some people don't come back from that. You put them in those type of facilities for a period of time, and they're never the same. They don't finish school, and their lives just spiral from there.
Oh, yeah.
They get in with the wrong people.
There's a couple stories where these kids have gotten in there and actually hurt themselves or, you know, committed suicide based on this.
Yeah.
I mean...
Or were killed by other kids.
Well, I mean, I don't think...
Kids killing kids.
I don't think...
I think I saw that on 2020 the other day.
I don't think the juvenile systems are quite like Oz. I mean, I think they're a bit...
Oh, they're just as bad.
I don't know. So
they just have smaller weapons.
So what these two schmucks did, I'm not calling them a judge anymore, they're schmucks.
They're schmucks.
They shut down the county-run system, the different facilities there in 2002, basically saying that it was unsafe.
Yeah, they ruled on that.
Yeah.
They
argued there was no other option than to outsource these private facilities.
So that's how they got it all set up in the first place, is that they diverted everybody there by shutting down the ones that were open.
Yeah. Now, originally, these guys, when this was all found out, they had negotiated plea agreements, and it called for both the schmucks to serve up to 7 years in prison, pay fines, and restitution, and they had to accept responsibility for the crime.
That's not nearly enough.
And no, it wasn't. But what happened was, is that this guy showed up at the plea hearing. And what he said was, is that he admitted that he tried to conceal payments to the company, but he denied sentencing juveniles who did not deserve it or that it was a quid pro quo basis. So basically he said, I did take the kickbacks for getting the places built, but I didn't sentence anybody who didn't deserve it. And I didn't quid pro quo this for that. Mm-hmm. I didn't do this for that with him.
Right.
And basically at that plea hearing, the judge didn't accept it. Because what happens when you have a plea hearing in criminal law? There has to be a factual basis for the plea, a statement of facts. Basically, like I said, it's a statement of facts detailing an individual crime and its particulars, stipulated to by the prosecution and the defense, which forms the basis by which a judge can accept a guilty plea from the defendant. So that's part of the plea hearing, or the guilt hearing.
And he's saying he wasn't guilty.
Well, he said, he kind of was like, well, I kind of did it, but I didn't do all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't what was agreed to.
Right.
The prosecutor said, no, you have to agree to this and this. And so basically, this judge, Judge Edwin Kosick, which I really appreciate he did this, he rejected the plea agreement and citing post-guilty plea conduct and expressions from the defendants and ruled did not satisfy the terms of the agreement. So he said, I'm rejecting the plea offer. Now, this is different than if it had been a nolle contendere plea or no contest plea, which is also called an Alford plea or a Kennedy plea here in West Virginia.
Right.
That's where basically you say, you know what, they have so much evidence against me. The only thing I can reasonably do in this is to plead no contest to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that if that had been the terms of the plea agreement, that had been fine.
Right.
He wouldn't have had to admit anything. But what they did is they basically tried to kind of hem and haw and, well, you know, I didn't really do it, which that's not going to fly.
Well, that's, you know, we talked last week about Bob Kraft,
mm-hmm.
and they've offered him the same sort of deal. He has to plead guilty, but they're offering him community service and some things like that, pay a fine and some things like that that he'll have to do in return.
Yeah.
So, but he does have to admit guilt, and they said they're willing to show him the movies they have of him for him to decide if they have enough evidence to prove him guilty.
Yeah. In denying it, the judge wrote that the two schmucks continued to deny their crimes even in the face of overwhelming evidence and therefore did not merit sentences that were well below the federal sentencing guidelines. Attorneys for the two schmucks brought a motion requesting reconsideration of the judge's rejection of the plea, and the motion was denied. And basically, the judge, they had to withdraw their guilty pleas, and it resulted in a jury trial for one of them. So basically, they withdrew their pleas. They were charged on a 48-count indictment against both of them, including racketeering, fraud, money laundering, extortion, bribery, and federal tax violations.
Good.
Yes, they. I mean, they essentially threw the book at them, which mm-hmm. as well they should.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, and I don't know if it was pride or what, but just wouldn't admit to doing it. And it comes probably down from their whole entitlement as being these all-powerful, you know, judges sentencing these juveniles, first-time offenders, to these facilities they got kickbacks from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a couple of schmucks.
They didn't care about those kids at all. That's how much those kids meant to them, is they don't think they did anything wrong. They think they gave those kids what they deserved. If they didn't do that, they probably did something else.
Yeah.
So they were doing the world a favor doing that.
I mean, I don't really rally against people so much, but man, these guys are schmucks.
That's kind of the way Lowry, whatever, acted when they removed him from the Supreme Court, that they didn't have any right to do that he was just doing his job, and he tried every way in the world to get the case dismissed and everything else.
That's true. He did. They were actually, pending trial, they had $1 million in bail, but the prosecutors even want it raised higher, but the judge denied that and said the bail was adequate. Now, some of the other players in this, because you're wondering, okay, well, what happened to these guys who ran these facilities? Well, Robert Powell, he was an attorney and co-owner of one of the two juvenile facilities. He pled guilty. Tax evasion conspiracy in connection with the $770,000 kickbacks he repaid to the two schmucks. He had his law license suspended due to the criminal conviction. There was another guy named Robert Miracle, and he was a prominent real estate developer who built the two juvenile places. He pleaded guilty, failing to disclose the felony, and he failed to tell a grand jury he paid $2.1 million to the two schmucks as a finder's fee. Yeah, he had to pay $2.15 million to fund local children's health and welfare programs, and he faced up to 3 years in prison, and he was released from federal custody in 2015 after serving a one-year sentence. Sandra Brullo, she was deputy director of forensic services for the probation office, agreed to plead guilty to obstruction of justice. She basically went back and backdated a recommendation of a placement she made concerning a single juvenile. So basically, she changed her original recommendation of placement to probation on one case. Hmm. So I don't know why she did that for one case. Maybe it's the one she felt really bad about, and who knows. But so those are the three people, the two people who were owners of the facilities or whatever, mm-hmm. and one of the probation officers. It eventually went to trial in February of 2011, and the federal jury convicted Ciavarelli on 12 of the 39 remaining counts he faced, including racketeering, a crime in which prosecutors said the former judge, now schmuck, used children as pawns to enrich himself. Racketeering. The jury agreed, the prosecutors, that he and Cohen had taken illegal payments of nearly $1 million from a youth center, then hid the money. That's what the jury found.
Well, I would think they would have to go and just about release everybody that appeared before them, because their case would have to be overturned because they've been tampered with. I don't know exactly what the legal term is for that, but they certainly throws everything into doubt, anybody that was sent by those judges.
Well, yeah, I mean, there actually was something that came about as a result of that, which I'll kind of get into here in a minute. But before we go any further, I think we maybe have a couple of motions or a motion before the court.
Yes, if it please your schmuckship, we would like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
What are you calling schmuckship?
Well, you're the judge there in this situation, so I guess it's you.
I've repeatedly told you I'm not the judge in this situation.
Well, I'm the one addressing somebody. I got to address somebody. You're the one I'm addressing. We have with us today on the docket, Sleep Number. Now, Sleep Number is your best friend in getting a good night's sleep. Sleep Number pillows we can highly recommend, as we have those once we read our instructions and adjusted them to just the proper sleeping angle and thickness and softness or denseness.
It's the only pillow you can get with instructions, I think.
Yeah.
They're really good. You should get one. But a good night's sleep gives you more energy, puts you in a better mood, and makes you more productive.
The new Sleep Number 360 Smart Bed helps everyone from parents to pro athletes remember the NFL thing. And it helps them improve their daily performance through proven quality sleep.
And the thing is, a lot of couples disagree on a mattress firmness. Sleep Number 360 Smart Beds let you choose your ideal firmness on each side, so it's just right for both of you.
I want it firmer. The Sleep Number 360 smart beds are so smart, they sense your every move and automatically adjust to you, keeping you sleeping comfortably throughout the night.
And Sleep Number has been ranked highest in customer satisfaction with mattresses by J.D. Power. For 2018 award information, just visit jdpower.com.
Now, here's what we're asking you to do. Come in now and save up to $500 on select Sleep Number 360 smart beds.
And you're only going to find Sleep Number at one of their 575 Sleep Number stores nationwide. Visit sleepnumber.com/court to find the one nearest you.
That's sleepnumber.com/court to find the one nearest you. And Mike and Tommy say, nighty night, little buckaroos.
Now, following Ciavarelli's conviction, he and his lawyer appeared on the steps of the courthouse to give an impromptu press conference. But this press conference was actually interrupted by Sandy Fonzo, and her son Edwin Kinzakowski had committed suicide after the schmuck had adjudicated him to placement despite him being a first offender. So that's one of the things that popped up there that was kind of a very traumatic thing that took place after this. Now, Ciavarelli was sentenced to 28 years in federal prison as a result of his conviction. He was actually held in Ashland at a low-security federal prison in eastern Kentucky, which is right across the border from here.
Well, if it's that Boyd County one, they are having all kinds of trouble.
Well, it's not that one. The Boyd County one is not a federal holding facility.
Oh, okay.
Now, the Carter County one is, but the Boyd County is not.
Oh, that's good, because they have escapes, and they have people waking up dead, and they were cited for constitutional violations.
I've been to both of those facilities, and I had to meet with a client at the Boyd County one, and they had a little office for me, and it was like it was off the main room there. And so there's the main area where they control all the doors and whatnot. And they put me in a little side room, which opened up with a window, and it looked into like a garage area with a garage door that came up. And so I'm there meeting with my client, the garage door opens, some guys walk in, they walk through my little office and say, "Oh, excuse me, we were coming in." And then they go into the main room. And I'm in there talking to my client. The garage door's open. I'm like, this guy's going to make a break for it.
And I'm not going to stop him.
No. He didn't run.
He left the garage door open.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
Well, it's no wonder they have all the problems over there.
Yeah, so
they said they would use tasers as punishment over there for inmates. Hey, you okay? You're going to get mouthy here. They just zap them a little bit. And those were regular forms of punishment for them. You're not supposed to torture prisoners, even if they are prisoners.
No wonder people were escaping. They had to get out of there.
Yeah.
Now, the Carter County one is it's a federal facility. It's much more secure. So I've never actually been to the one in Ashland. I don't know which one they're talking about. But this guy continued to appeal it and appeal it and appeal it. And finally, basically, on January 9th, 2018, a federal judge threw out his convictions for racketeering and conspiracy and to commit racketeering and conspiracy to commit money laundering. But he upheld the contention that he basically failed to raise the statute of limitations claim on those charges. He ordered a new trial on those counts, but allowed the honest services fraud convictions to stand. So he continued to appeal it. And then basically on January 9th, 2018, a federal judge threw out some of his convictions and ordered a new trial on some of those counts. And basically, just recently, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit set a tentative date of March 7th, so just, a couple weeks ago, or last week, to find out whether or not the trial would go forward or not and see if he's going to have any trial on this. But basically, he's supposed to be serving until, he's under a sentence until December 30th, 2035. So, he's basically, would probably die in prison if he doesn't get out. So, no wonder he keeps on trying to appeal and appeal it. So, now the other guy, the other schmuck.
I hope they sent him to a private prison.
Yeah, there you go. Was Conahan. He was sentenced to 17 and a half years in federal prison. And he pled guilty himself. And he actually accepted it rather than dispute it. And he was being held at Federal Correction Institution in Miami in Florida. So he got sent to Florida, which is nicer than Ashland.
Yeah, a lot nicer.
And so he was scheduled for release in 2026. The one kind of good thing that happened out of this is, and I want to say good, because I guess it probably hurts their families, but, you know, whatever. These other families are torn apart, too. These guys lost their status of being a judge, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
They were forced to relinquish their law license. It's good.
They weren't allowed to wear the wigs anymore.
No wigs. They're actually prohibited from wearing wigs. They lost their pensions. So they didn't get their pensions.
That's good. That's always burns me up when they get it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they got their pensions taken away. So, I mean, as best could be done, I think justice was served what took place eventually. Now, if they had done the plea agreement and only served 7 years, I'm not sure justice would have been served.
No. No, but that shows you how stupid they were, or how greedy they were, or something, or how much they placed themselves above the law.
Yeah.
They thought they were immune to it.
Now,
people will surprise you with their greed.
Now, basically, that Cia Varela, he was trying to say that he only sentenced people who deserved it. Now, his sentences were unusually harsh. He sentenced a quarter of juveniles to detention. Now, the state rate was 1 out of 10. He's sending over twice as many to detention.
Oh, yeah.
He was ignoring pleas for leniency from prosecutors and the probation departments. I mean,
he had to fill it up.
Yeah.
I mean, more that went, the more money he got.
Exactly. Now, some states don't require children to have counsel present. They can waive counsel at their first hearing or if they enter a plea or things like that. Now, like I said, in West Virginia, I don't know of any juvenile hearings that occur without counsel. I just don't think it's done. Now, that's locally. I guess there could be different counties and circuits where they do that. But I know, at least here in Cabell County and Wayne County, juveniles do not appear in front of judges unless they have counsel. So I think that's a good thing. And again, I think it's an area that is ripe for problems because it's cut off to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that's a confidential proceeding like that, you have to have lawyers in there to make sure that all sides are represented appropriately. If you don't, have the public access to it, which allows people to say, hey, something's not right here.
Right.
So...
yeah, hopefully you got somebody that'd be on your side that would stand up or be able to say, hey, this is what happened and this wasn't right.
Yeah. One parent, this is back after a town hall when all this was kind of happening back in 2009. She was there and her son, Kevin, who was 18 at the time in 2009, was sentenced to 90 days in a detention facility for a simple assault case that everyone said would result in probation since Kevin had never been in trouble before and the kid he hit only had a black eye. You know, just, you know, you run in the middle kind of fight. Maybe Kevin was a bit of the aggressor or being an a-hole or whatever, but
kids get punched.
Yeah. Give him community service, give him a stern lecture, mm-hmm. give him probation, mm-hmm. make sure he doesn't get in trouble for a while. The mom said, it's horrible to have your child taken away in shackles right in front of you when you think you're going to go home with them. It was nice to see them sitting on the other side of the bench.
Yeah. I imagine there was a lot of people wanting to see those judges pay for what they did.
Yeah.
Wanting to see their shame. An embarrassment.
But, I mean, if you think about it, a private prison or a profit prison, it's the perfect racket. You have the government basically order people in your prison, and if they run, the government will literally hunt them down and put them in there for you. You just have to house them and sit back and collect your fee.
Right.
If they screw up by some arbitrary system that you have in your facility, they stay longer. Hey, that's better for you. Your investment just kind of keeps on churning.
Yeah.
It reminds me like those... kind of addictive, spammy type little phone games you play where you start out with a farmer and as you farm more property, you earn more money. And what does that do? That allows you to buy more farmers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you farm more and more, then you can upgrade your farmer to a better one.
Yeah.
And you buy more upgraded farmers than that. And it keeps on going. It's one of these kind of self-perpetuating cycles that doesn't really have an end in sight.
Yeah, but the upgrades aren't farmers. They're judges' houses.
Well, I don't know. I seriously doubt that's the case. I think this is an anomaly.
Well, I think, what they lose sight of when you go to it for profit. They're looking to, everybody coming in is dollars for them. So yeah. They want people coming in. The purpose of prison is supposed to be rehabilitation. It's not supposed to warehouse them or put them in a situation where most of them are going to end up having to stay longer because they violate the rules or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's what they're looking for. There was one that I came across. It said, no place in the world imprisons people at a higher per capita rate than the state of Louisiana. And that incarceration pays for the profiteers who run the state's private prisons. For the incarcerated, it's a totally different story. In 1998, the New York Times described one of Louisiana's privately run facilities, the Tallulah Correctional Center for Youth, as possibly the worst such prison in the nation, a site rife with brutality, cronyism, and neglect. Now, this one lady, her son was sent there, and she didn't know anything about it at the time that he went. And he said, can you tell us how the prison came about? And it said, the Trans-American Development Corporation built this prison with zero background in youth development, rehabilitation, trauma, or mental health treatment. They were simply businessmen. And the money for Tallulah had to be borrowed against Louisiana's credit. So in order to close it, they would need to default and drive down the whole state's credit rating. So even though everyone knew rather quickly that Tallulah was a hellhole, there was no political will to close it. Louisiana's legislative auditor found that between January 1995 and April 2001, three executives at Trans-American Develop Associates received $8.7 million from the Tallulah deal. Even after lawsuits forced the state to take control of the prison in 1999, these three continued to grab over $500,000 per year. How did this factor into the appalling condition of the prisons? Said you had this profit motive in there and no mechanism for oversight. The level of violence and mismanagement was stunning. It said that, how could it proliferate like that in the facility for the youth? They said it was for a number of reasons. The only place to file a grievance was with the Louisiana Department of Corrections. So they said they called it the place where complaints went to die.
Yeah.
And said, remember, many families feared retribution against their children on the inside if they complained about what was going on, you know. So this lady said that she complained and weeks later got a form letter back saying they were investigating, but she never received another response about it again. It said Trans-American operated under a shroud of secrecy. They hired guards and covered up violence. The secrecy began to unravel only after the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana and the U.S. Department of Justice got involved and launched a lawsuit. The Louisiana Secretary of Education came out to assess the situation as a result of the lawsuit. She told this lady whose son went in there, said that your son is going to die if he stays there under the conditions she found.
Oh, my Lord.
And said the prison health facilities at Tallulah couldn't accommodate the number of serious injuries and sexual assaults, so some injured children had to be treated outside the prison in public health facilities, and that exposed some of the horrors of Tallulah, too. And so that brought about, in Louisiana, the Juvenile Justice Reform Act of 2003, and they were able to finally close it through the convergence of the right people at the right time getting involved in it. But they were, you know, looking back at it, and they said, you know, how could all this have come about? It said that the Prison Legal News reports that Damon Hininger, the CEO of the nation's largest private prison corporation, received a base salary of $882,807 in 2015, with over $2.5 million in other compensation. George Zoli, the CEO of the GEO Group, the country's second largest private prison corporation, pocketed a $1 million salary with $5.6 million in additional compensation. And they said that there was He said that they once saw a GEO memo to shareholders that talked about how it made sense to invest in private prisons in Louisiana because the state had an increasing population of kids in the juvenile system that would soon be fed into the adult system, ensuring a large inmate population for private prisons.
And I will tell you.
So it's like the farm leagues. They were running the farm leagues and feeding the pros.
But I will tell you, I mean, based on simple analysis and business analysis, that's spot on. They're right. They are right. If you're running a business, I mean, you want to go where your business is going to grow, right? It's a simple supply and demand type logic. I mean, you got to have the supply there, and they're saying that's where it is. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's.
But, and they're creating it. Creating the supply and increasing the demand.
Yeah. They've got their hands on both sides of it.
Yeah. But the other thing that they notice too is that they see stark racial disparities at every level of the juvenile legal system.
Oh, I guarantee it.
From the profiling and arrest to sentencing and detention. And it said that you walk in, and this was at Tallulah at the time, you walk in and there are about 3 white kids to about 85 black kids. That was true throughout the state. The racial disparities were blatant and shocking. A white probation officer told me that my kid got caught up in the correction system that was really meant for black kids.
Wow.
I mean, that's how blatant they were
about it. Well, you remember when we talked about non-unanimous juries, which dates back to essentially racist things as well.
Right.
And Louisiana was one of the places that had that.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
because they didn't want a couple of people on there to be able to throw off the conviction.
Yeah. So
they put that in there. But I've found another report that broke down the statistics on youth confinement in the United States. And it said on any given day, nearly 53,000 youth are held in facilities away from home as a result of juvenile or criminal justice involvement. Generally speaking, state juvenile systems handle cases involving defendants under the age of 18. This is not a hard and fast rule, however. Every state makes exceptions for younger people to be prosecuted as adults in some situations or for certain offenses. Of the 48,000 youth in juvenile facilities, more than 2/3 are 16 or older. Troublingly, more than 500 confined children are no more than 12 years old. Black and American Indian youth are overrepresented in juvenile facilities, while white youth are underrepresented. These racial disparities are particularly pronounced when it comes to black boys and American Indian girls. While just 14% of all youth under 18 in the U.S. are black, 43% of boys and 34% of girls in juvenile facilities are black. And even excluding youth held in Indian country facilities, American Indians make up 3% of girls and 1.5% of boys in juvenile facilities, despite comprising less than 1% of all youth nationally.
Hmm. So, you know, I will say from my experience here, and I don't deal much with what we would call a JD case, which is juvenile delinquent type case. I don't deal with many of them, but I see them a lot as they're going on. Like I said, because I see the courtroom full of people waiting to be called back in these confidential hearings. I don't get to go in them because I'm not part of them. And it's pretty rare that you see somebody in a JD proceeding come to court locked up. I'd say it's the exception, not the rule, in my experience here in our court system here in West Virginia. I think that when you see a juvenile locked up, it's more of a shock. It's like, oh, wow, that kid must have done something really bad. Whereas in criminal court for adults, I'd say the majority of people you see come in are actually locked up and they're coming in. So I think it's...
It must vary state to state.
I think so.
How they handle these things, how they've decided to.
Yeah.
Because they've even got a caveat here that says, to be sure, many justice-involved youth are found guilty of serious offenses and could conceivably pose a risk in their community. But a disturbing number of youth held in juvenile facilities are not even serving a sentence. They're just placed in there because of things that have gone on, and they place them in a juvenile detention facility.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, like, if you have a kid and they somehow get into the system and they're completely out of control at home, they're completely out of control at school, they're completely out of control anywhere you put them, basically, I mean, there's not much else you can do.
Right. But I don't think there's a large number that fall in that category. There are ones that do, but I don't think that's a large number.
Probably not, but I do think that large amount of them here in West Virginia that I see are, that's kind of what you run across is like, there's just literally nothing else you can do with these kids. So we have to put them somewhere. Now, I mean, there are some that probably get locked up for other things. I remember like when I was in high school, some kids like for some reason shot a gun into a house. They're just driving along shooting guns into houses. They got sent away for a while, which I think they probably should have been.
Well, yeah, that's not a good thing.
No, that's a pretty serious thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't hear about kids getting sent away when I was growing up, and I think that trend has kind of continued here for the most part.
Well, I always heard when I was a kid that if you got in trouble, they sent you to a place called Pruny Town.
Say Pruny Town, yeah.
Yeah, the first thing they did to you is they shaved your head. And I didn't want to have my head shaved. I liked having hair. I wanted long hair.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to have my head shaved, so I kind of stayed out of trouble so I wouldn't have to go to Pruny Town and get my head shaved.
Well, your dream came true. You got long hair.
I know. I didn't go to Pruny Town. But in the conclusion on this study on the youth being held, it said, like the criminal justice and juvenile justice systems themselves, the effort to reverse mass incarceration for adults and to deinstitutionalize justice-involved youth have remained curiously distinct, but the two systems have more problems and potentially more solutions in common than one might think. Like so many adults who are unnecessarily detained in jails, thousands of justice-involved children and adolescents languish in detention centers without even being found delinquent. They, too, are locked up in large numbers for low-level, nonviolent offenses, and many youth face similarly dehumanizing conditions when they are locked up in juvenile facilities that look and feel like adult jails and prisons. For advocates and policymakers working to find alternatives to incarceration, ending youth confinement should be a top priority. And this is what they recommend doing. With this big picture view, it should be obvious that many improvements can be made to better respond to the behaviors and needs of justice-involved youth. Many justice-focused organizations have proposed policy changes at every stage of the process, but to address some of the issues discussed in this report, policymakers can start by 1. Updating laws to reflect our current understanding of brain development and criminal behavior over the life course, such as raising the age of juvenile court jurisdiction and ending the prosecution of youth as adults. 2. Removing all youth from adult jails and prisons. 3. Shifting youth away from confinement and investing in non-residential community-based programs. 4. Limiting pretrial detention and youth confinement to the very few who, if released, would pose a clear risk to public safety. 5. Eliminating detention or residential placement for technical violations of probation and diverting status offenses away from the juvenile justice system. And lastly, strengthening and reauthorizing the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act to promote alternatives to youth incarceration and support critical juvenile justice system improvements.
I agree with that, but I do think that some juveniles need to be charged as adults. I think there are certain category of crimes that are just so egregious, you just have to do it.
Well, did you see what case the Supreme Court has recently decided they're going to take up?
What's that?
That, you remember the D.C. sniper?
Yeah.
Malvo, mm-hmm. I think was his name, was a kid. There was a 17-year-old kid with an adult man.
Yeah.
Now, the adult man was executed in 2009 or something like that. He was executed for his murders. The 17-year-old, he was 17 at the time, he was put in prison for life without parole.
Right.
The Supreme Court has decided they will hear his appeal to be released, stating that he had been brainwashed by the adult and he was only 17 and wasn't capable of making that decision. So it'll be interesting to see what the Supreme Court says about that.
That will
him
be interesting.
Actually,
yeah,
being tried as an adult, you know, and serving an adult sentence.
That'll have ramifications for all the juvenile cases that transfer to adult status.
Yeah.
So now, I mean, if the Supreme Court goes for that, that's going to bring up a lot of cases for kids that committed crimes that were pretty egregious, got that handed life sentences.
Yeah, so. Because this is about as cold-blooded as you get. I mean, they were driving around just randomly picking people and picking them off.
Yeah.
And sniping them. So, I mean, that's short of torture, there isn't much any worse.
No, I remember that was like a horrible thing going on when it did. It was terrifying.
Yeah, it was around D.C. and the mm-hmm. Virginia Beltway around there or something like that. And, yeah, and you know, you didn't know where it was going to turn up next. They were just driving by and shooting people in gas stations and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was just random. There was no particular kind of target or anything. It was just anybody at all. It didn't matter.
Yeah. Well, now getting back to the whole private prison for profit type model, it seems to be in the decline.
Well, you know, Obama kind of, I won't say outlawed it, but he sent a memo to his attorney general and said he didn't want federal prisoners housed in private prisons anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had been operating that way until Trump ordered Sessions to go ahead and put them back in private prisons.
I did wonder if he had a rationale for that, or basically just because Obama did it, he was going to change it.
Well, who knows? but Sessions kind of said that it was okay because it gives them better flexibility in how they handle their prisoners.
Yeah.
Now, they didn't ever do away with them because the state still had the option of using private prisons. So you would think maybe that would do away with them when the president says we're not going to put any more prisoners in there, but evidently the states were keeping them flush. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, states can have their private prisons too. I mean, it's just that was the federal government's policy not to put federal prisoners in there.
Right.
Which I don't think there's as many federal private prisons anyway.
But there has to be a reason, though, why he would single out private prisons.
Yeah.
I mean, it's documented that they are not run as well as government prisons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do
There's
have
more man's inhumanity to man.
They do have a lobby, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. When you've got guys that are making millions of dollars off of them being there, you better believe that they've got money to spend on telling congressmen, hey, this is a good thing to do. That's why they need to do away with lobbyists, and they need to do away with donations. They need to do away with money in politics and all that kind of stuff. It all needs to be regulated.
Yeah, I agree.
Term limits is the other part of that. The longer they sit in there, the more they get rotten. Like eggs. They're just like eggs sitting there. Eventually, they're going to get rotten.
I don't have time for a soap box episode
and
right
some
now.
Some of them were already cracked anyway.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions about some of the things we talked about and see if he can remember or call them back through that beautiful mane of his over his brain holes.
Yes. Charlie was remarking on my hair today, and she said, Pop, your hair looks messy. I said, no, I have long, flowing, golden locks. She said, your hair is gray. My hair is golden. You're describing my hair.
All right. So, first question. What is a factual basis?
A factual basis? That means something that really happened, that it's true, that it has proof.
Okay. And in the scheme of today's episode, what would be the context?
I have no idea.
Well, whenever there's a plea hearing,
yeah.
Oh. Basically the defendant has to provide a factual basis for what their participation in the crime was in order for the judge to accept the plea.
Oh, okay. So he has to accept that he was guilty if he's going to place a guilty plea.
Yeah.
He can't say, yeah, I'll take the guilty plea, but I didn't do it.
Well, no. There is a way they can kind of do that, though.
Yeah, I mean, with an Alford or Kennedy plea.
Right, which is also called a no
contest. But that's a no contest. Yeah, you're just saying, look, you probably got enough evidence to convict me, so I'm going to just walk away, hold up my hands, and say, okay, better luck next time.
That's right. Now, that's already one of the things that's kind of agreed to at the beginning, is that with the plea deal, that it can be an Alford or Kennedy plea. Now, there's been times where I've actually had a case where it's come for the time for my client to give a factual basis, and they say, I can't remember anything. I was drunk. And so the judge is like, well, I got to have some basis for it. And I said, well, judge, can we change this into a Kennedy plea? And the judge is like, well, does the prosecution have a problem with that? And like, nope. If he doesn't remember, he doesn't remember. So then it'll be converted into a Kennedy plea. Say, like, all right, well, what would the state show? And then that's when the prosecutor has to say, well, here's what the state's is willing to show. And so, you know, it's kind of a weird situation sometimes, but sometimes your client actually can't accept responsibility for it because they don't remember it. So, but there's a lot of evidence and, you know, they probably did it.
Meth is a powerful drug.
It is. Well, I thought I had one more term to talk about, but I don't. So that's it.
Well, good. Well, no, that's not good. I failed.
You did. You failed.
I missed the only one.
I'm going to send you to prison.
Is that on a factual basis?
It's on you.
I know, I'll take a Kennedy plea, but I'm not going to plead. I don't remember. So I'm not going to plead actually guilty.
Well, it was kind of an easy one, though. I can't believe you didn't get the factual basis one.
Well, I didn't have it in the right context. If you had said, if you were going to enter a guilty plea and I said it has to be on a factual basis, what does that mean? And then I would have said, oh, it's because I would actually have to admit that I'm guilty for you to accept my plea.
Right, but that would have been a softball.
Well, I've got a soft head.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.